From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, YouTube caused a big stir when it began producing original content, but now the internet's biggest video platform is changing course. Then the creator of Narcos explains why they never interviewed the drug lords they are depicting.
They always spin a version of the story that makes them seem like they had no choice. It's not me, it's everybody else and the government and all this. And by the way, a fair amount of that's probably true.
And veteran musicians Dave Alvin and Jimmy Dale Gilmore team up for an album to celebrate their roots. All that coming up on this Friday edition of The Frame. The convergence of tech companies and Hollywood seems to be hitting a speed bump. YouTube is scaling back on its push into the original scripted programming game. Don't worry if you're a fan of its Karate Kid reboot, Cobra Kai. That show isn't going away. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, well, that might be part of the problem. We don't know how many people have actually been watching the YouTube premium shows, but it's notable that at a time when Apple is making original shows and Facebook Watch has original programming, the internet's largest video platform is shifting gears. Natalie Jarvie wrote about this story for The Hollywood Reporter.
YouTube has made a number of attempts to court Hollywood over the years. And a couple of years ago, they made their first real true push into Hollywood by hiring Suzanne Daniels away from MTV, committing to actually buying TV shows like those that you would find on a traditional television network. And when they started, they mostly bought shows that were unscripted, starring YouTubers like PewDiePie, and that worked for them for about a year. And then Suzanne, because she's a traditional Hollywood executive, wanted to, you know, make a bigger push into programming. She decided to start finding scripted shows that could be really buzzy, put YouTube on the map. And that's when she started to go after things like Cobra Kai, a Step Up reboot, shows that she knew would attract big audiences.
Was part of the original idea, too, that you might be able to see the pilots from these shows on regular YouTube, but if you wanted to watch something without the ads or to see the series themselves, you had to get a subscription to what used to be called YouTube Red or YouTube Premium, as it's called now?
That's right. Right around the same time that YouTube hired Suzanne Daniels, they also announced that they were going to launch a subscription service, which was totally new for them. They've been an ad-supported business for their whole lifespan, and this was the first time that they were saying, hey, we know some people don't want to watch ads, and if that's the case, you can pay, at that time it was $10 a month, and you can get all of the videos that you love on YouTube for free. And on top of that, you can also get these, you know, more premium shows that we're actually, you know, buying, and you can only get those if you subscribe.
So how did that end up doing? Is it part of the issue that people, once they got something for free, were a little unwilling to pay?
That's exactly it. You have to remember, too, YouTube's audience is pretty young, and it's not always easy for them to pull out a credit card and, you know, buy a subscription. Many of them have to ask their parents. So, you know, we don't actually know a lot about how that subscription service has been working, but it's fair to assume that probably not working that great, because YouTube is now going to start making all of its premium programming available for free with ads as well. So you'll still be able to get it on the subscription service if you want. For example, if you want to binge watch all 10 episodes of a show, you'll have to subscribe. But if you're fine with some ads and you want to watch it week to week, then you'll be able to do that going forward.
One YouTube original series that you mentioned is Cobra Kai. It's a continuation of the original Karate Kid storyline between Ralph Macchio and William Zabka, only now they're adults.
Wait, is this the karate guy? The guy from the tournament?
Oh, this is the guy whose ass you kicked.
Listen, it was a really close match, but if you want to get technical, I kicked his face. I'm just busting your chops.
It was an illegal kick.
So how did Cobra Kai do, and what's its future now?
So we only know what's going on with the first episode of Cobra Kai, the pilot episode. That one has been viewed more than 50 million times on YouTube. That's the only episode that's free. And we don't know a whole lot more about how it's done behind the paywall, although YouTube has said that it has, you know, done a fairly good job of converting subscribers. This is a show, though, that is going to have a second season, and it will still be behind the paywall. So you will still have to subscribe to get this show. But moving forward, future shows, that may not be the case.
What have been the lessons of some of the shows that were marginally successful or maybe even failed? Where is YouTube missing?
for YouTube is going to be in figuring out how to compete with the Netflixes, the Amazons, the Hulus. They're throwing billions of dollars a year at content, and YouTube just doesn't have that budget, which is kind of crazy to think about because they are owned by Google, which is one of the most valuable companies in the world, but their programming budget is pretty small. And so one of the lessons that I think Hollywood is taking from the moves that YouTube is making now is that it doesn't pay to be kind of half in something. You really have to go all in and really commit to producing premium programming that's at the level that you can find in all these other networks and channels, or else you just really shouldn't do it.
So one of the things that YouTube has been working on is the Doug Liman-produced Impulse. They ordered pilots for an adaptation of The Edge of 17 and a Ben Stiller-produced big rig drama called Dark Cargo. What does this scaling back message send to creators?
So YouTube isn't really talking yet about what the scale back will look like, but it's my understanding that they're going to still make a handful of buys in the kind of scripted programming space. They may just make fewer of them and be a bit more selective going forward. So in the near term, that's probably not going to have a huge impact, but when this pullback really starts in 2020, it will probably make YouTube less of a desirable platform. This could ultimately, though, be really good for the homegrown YouTube creators who've been on the platform for years. In this kind of premium programming push, YouTube has kind of moved away from some of those big deals with creators. They're still doing some, but not maybe as many as when they first got into programming. And as they move more toward this kind of free ad-supported programming, those creators draw big audiences for them, and we might find that they actually are the ones who are kind of the better fit going forward.
Even with this news, YouTube is still incredibly popular. How important is it to Google parent Alphabet?
YouTube has 1.8 billion logged in users. That's a massive audience. They're a huge advertising business, and they're very central to the Google plan going forward. So YouTube's not going away anytime soon. They're just still figuring out their Hollywood strategy.
Natalie Jarvie is the digital media editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Natalie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Up next on The Frame, the showrunner of Narcos talks about the Mexican drug cartel at the center of the new season. Among the names of notorious drug dealers, Miguel Angel Felix Gallardo isn't one that most Americans will recognize, but in Mexico, his exploits are the subject of songs. In the 1980s, Felix Gallardo, along with Don Neto and Rafael Caro Quintero, transformed the Guadalajara cartel from a regional marijuana industry into a cocaine trafficking empire and set the stage for the Mexican drug war as we know it today. Now, Felix Gallardo is the subject of Narcos Mexico, the fourth installment of the popular Netflix series. He's played by Diego Luna. Felix Gallardo's story culminated in the kidnapping, torture, and murder of Kiki Camarena, the heroic American agent who'd been assigned to the DEA's Guadalajara office. Michael Peña plays Camarena in the new season, which is currently on Netflix. When I spoke with showrunner Eric Newman, we talked about the devastating legacy of the Guadalajara cartel and the research that he did on its origins. We begin the conversation with why the name Felix Gallardo doesn't have quite the same familiar ring as Pablo Escobar.
Pablo Escobar coveted the attention. I think Escobar had a pathological need to be loved, particularly by the people of Colombia. Now, it's completely inauthentic. He's probably a sociopath, but he needed the attention, wanted the attention. I think he believed it would protect him. Gallardo went the other way. He, for the most part, sought anonymity. Once he no longer had anonymity, once he was, you know, a target in the investigation into the kidnap, torture, and murder of Kiki Camarena, he sought to paint himself as a businessman. But he would probably have preferred to stay completely anonymous. And he has served his time pretty quietly. You know, we tend not to talk to the traffickers in our research phase, and not because we're afraid of them, but, you know, we are, and they particularly are, we are heroes and victims in our own stories. You know, bad guys don't know they're bad, and they always spin a version of the story that makes them seem like they had no choice. It's not me, it's everybody else and the government and all this. And by the way, a fair amount of that is probably true. But in Gallardo's case, all we've really heard from him in the past 30 years is, you know, I'm a humble man, and the things that have been attributed to me are not me, but I'm pretty certain they are.
Michael Pena plays Kiki Camarena, who's a real DEA officer. It's my understanding he hadn't seen the earlier seasons of Narcos. Is that right?
No, he
hadn't. So what was your pitch to him?
Once we realized that we were going to tell the Guadalajara story, you can't tell it without Kiki Camarena. And Michael was, you know, in the same way that Diego Luna was atop our list for Gallardo, Michael was atop our list for Kiki. Because this is not a guy, and I've talked to many people who knew him. You know, he was a stubborn guy, Kiki Camarena. He was a very driven guy who had a code that he neither bend nor break for anyone. And so those characters tend to have, when you see them in a film or a television show, you know, they're not easy to like. And so Michael, as an actor, made up for that, you know, brought his sort of this charisma that he has, and he was really perfect for the part.
I want to play a scene about Kiki Camarena. This is as told by his wife to a group of friends.
When this kid comes to the table to tell his mom he can't go to the bathroom because there's a guy in there smoking pot.
Busted.
Right, so brand new federal agent here is like, I got this, heads off to the bathroom.
So what happened?
Well, it wasn't one guy. It was four.
Oh, I like those odds.
So he says to them, we can do this the easy way, or we can do it the hard way.
Turns out the easy way was to beat the shit out of me.
So I ask him, was it worth it? Are you happy now?
And I said, I have my possession, but now I have my assault, so damn right it was worth it.
Hell yeah.
I mean, one of the things that struck me,
true story,
is that Felix Gallardo and Kiki Camarena are each trying to build something.
Yes.
They're entrepreneurs. One, he's building an international drug ring. The other, an international anti-drug ring. Did you see their stories from the very beginning as parallel that
Absolutely.
Way?
Absolutely. I mean, they both see the future. Felix sees that pretty soon we're going to be able to run the whole game. And Kiki Camarena realizes if this happens, it's going to be very bad for the world. And they're both right. And I think the fact that they were both cops was always sort of interesting to us. You know, you had a guy who had a, you know, as I said, an uncompromising moral code, almost like a Western hero. And then you had a guy that perhaps living in the world he lived in, growing up the way he grew up, seeing Mexican corruption in law enforcement and politics, was incapable of having a code.
We're talking with Eric Newman, who's the executive producer and showrunner on Narcos Mexico. Camarena is no longer with us, but his family is still around.
Yep.
And you're telling the story of a true guy who, you know, lived and died doing what he thought was right. How do you approach his family about how you're going to represent him? And what were the important things that you wanted to make sure that you preserved?
I reached out to Mika Camarena, his wife, through my contacts in the DEA. And her memories of him were very honest. You know, it was, I don't think it was easy to be married to a DEA agent. You know, she moved her children to Guadalajara, and obviously he flirted with danger. I think what was important to her was, and I think it's important to all the law enforcement people that we work with, is not to glorify these people.
Both the DEA agents and the drug lords.
The DEA would actually like to be glorified more, but we don't always share the same ideology about the drug war. And, you know, cops tend to have a black and white view of things, but the reasons for their origin, why they became traffickers, is probably more interesting to us as writers than it is to them. They don't really want to understand it. And so I think it was very important to Mika, as it always is to the DEA people we work with, that we're not turning these guys into heroes, and we definitely don't turn them into heroes. And Kiki, you know, as sort of the first and most famous martyr in the drug war, there is a heroism to him. He's complicated and he's a human being, but what he does, the sacrifice that he makes and what it means, though perhaps hasn't yielded what you'd hope. It's not, you know, the drug war only got worse
right.
from then.
Gallardo so is in jail, but yeah,
yes,
but that's
you know,
about
and,
it.
And whether Gallardo is, you know, and I think what the show says in the season is that, you know, it's not really the narcos. There's tremendous complicity on the part of governments and law enforcement in Mexico and in the United States.
We were going to talk about this show a year ago, and yes. it was around that time that your location scout, Carlos Munoz Partal,
yep.
was killed.
Yes.
How did that change the way you saw the show and the way you saw your job as a producer?
On a personal level, it was very hard. Particularly, you know, you have a responsibility as a producer for the safety of your crew, and no show is worth the loss of a life. We were told by Mexican law enforcement, and I believe this to be true, that it had nothing to do with the show and nothing to do with the narcotics business. It was
just wrong place, wrong time.
Wrong place, wrong time. What I was told was it happened in Hidalgo, which is north of DFA, and the Pemex pipeline runs through this area, and there's a lot of pipeline theft. So, you know, guys will back a truck up against the pipeline, punch a hole in it, fill up a tanker, and drive off. And so it's black market fuel. And Carlos was in this area. He had been there before. He'd shot there before. And so he was taking pictures. And, you know, to someone who has never seen a location scout, a guy walking around with a camera taking pictures could be an investigator, could be maybe a journalist, a cop. And so they, you know, they reacted.
One thing that it feels sadly true is that you could do seasons of this show until the end of time.
Probably.
That you have done cocaine stories, you've done some marijuana stories. Now we're in the middle of an opioid epidemic. Does it feel as if, in a horrible way, that the world keeps giving you material for seasons beyond your imagining?
Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, we more people die every year from opioids than died in than Americans were killed in the Vietnam War. I mean, it's across every racial and economic line. And still, we like to find an enemy and go after them because we seem to be unable to look inward and think, okay, this is something that we need to deal with as a nation. And because we live in this world where drug users are losers, are considered losers, and you know that this behavior is criminalized rather than being treated as a healthcare crisis, which is what it is, we're never going to make any progress.
Eric Newman is the executive producer and showrunner of Narcos Mexico. Eric, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, veteran musicians Dave Alvin and Jimmy Dale Gilmore team up for an album that celebrates their roots. Gallardo cayó allá por Guadalajara, Rafa Caro en Costa Rica, y Don Neto allá en Vallarta. Por eso muchos platican que acabaron. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Two music veterans have made their first album together. Downey to Lubbock is a collaboration by Southern California native Dave Alvin and Texas troubadour Jimmy Dale Gilmore. The album includes a few originals, but most are from the folk country canon, tunes that recall their roots at the landmark L.A. folk club, the Ash Grove. When they spoke with Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett, Gilmore and Alvin discussed making music together and the modern relevance of folk icon Woody Guthrie.
Hi, I'm Jimmy Dale Gilmore. When I was a kid, country music was all there was, the only kind of music that existed in my world. My dad was a guitar player, but the music he loved was the old Roy Acuff and honky-tonk music. All around the water tank, waiting for a name is spelled J-I-M-M-I-E because I was named for Jimmy Rogers, and his name was spelled that way. I'm originally from Lubbock, Texas, by way of Austin and L.A.
This is Dave Alvin, and you call me Dave. I grew up hearing everything, you know. Had very hip older cousins that were into a variety of musics. And my cousin J.J. grew up on a ranch up in the northwest San Fernando Valley, so he grew up liking Buck Owens and things like that, George Jones. So what I do is just a combination of my cousin's taste in music. You know? Sweet thing. A young and tender, sweet thing, I'll let your heart surrender. I got addicted to live music pretty early on. You know, my mom drove me to see Jimi Hendrix a couple of times. She was afraid that I'd be dosed with LSD if I bought a hot dog at the stand, you know. And so she made me peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and that's all I could eat. She would sit out in the car while me and my friends, you know, I was 12, 13 years old. Yeah, I saw Jimi Hendrix twice in 1 year, and then that led me pretty quickly to my brother Phil and I discovering this place about 22 miles or so from where we grew up in Downey called the Ash Grove.
Ironically, last year when Dave and I started touring together, almost immediately we started discovering this common background, and it had to do with the fact that in the mid-60s, I had come out to the West Coast, and I hung out at the Ash Grove all the time. So I had become friends with Lightnin' Hopkins and with Sun House, and it turned out we knew a bunch of the same old songs.
We're basically three chord guys. You know, if it was Jimmy and me with, you know, Bjork, then it might be an odd pairing.
The crops are all in, the peaches are rotting.
Woody Guthrie has been one of my major influences. I wasn't really aware of him when I was young, except Oklahoma Hills, which was a country hit. So I hadn't really particularly noticed him until the folk revival started happening. And I discovered Woody Guthrie's music and then his writing, and I just became a hardcore fan.
600 miles to the Mexico border. They chase us like outlaws, like wrestlers and thieves.
That song, Deportee, I think it's Woody at his best. First of all, it's beautiful. It's incredibly well-crafted song. And it's deceptively simple because it's so evocative, it's so poignant, and, you know, that had a real deep intention.
And they rode the trucks till they took down and died. Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita.
I had trepidation about recording the song because a million people have done it.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita.
But what I did the night before we recorded is I sat up late and listened to about, and I'm not exaggerating, about 120, 125 versions of Deportee.
Adios, mi amigos, Jesús y María.
I was making little producer notes like, okay, no mandolin, no accordion, you know. And I just said, okay, we'll do it as a waltz and we'll do it like this and blah, blah, blah. And then when we got to the studio the next day, all it really took was he just sang the first line and it all fell into place and it was like, okay.
The crops are all in, the peaches are rotting.
Jimmy's got a voice that cuts through artifice and cuts through jadedness and irony and all that stuff. It's just a pure expression. You know, some people oversing it, some people undersing it, and he sings it perfectly.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalina.
As Dave has been saying, he introduces the song on our shows as being both timeless and timely. The actual title of the song is Plane Wreck at Los Gatos. Woody read in the paper that some people had been killed, and it was migrant workers that were being taken back to Mexico, and that the song says, all they'll call you will be deportee.
My father's old father, he waded that river.
So in the song, he puts names to the people and puts life to them. It's a very sad situation that song would still have pertinence We should have gotten over that a long time ago. Instead, it seems to be getting worse.
They chase us like outlaws, like rustlers, like thieves.
Woody wrote so many songs that, you know, I think he stands sort of like Stephen Foster. But then even more that he was such a social activist. You know, he had so much heart.
Dave Alvin and Jimmy Dale Gilmore's album is titled Downey to Lubbock. They're playing a series of dates in Southern California from December 7th through the 9th. And that's it for this week. Remember, you can get this show as a podcast on Spotify, Stitcher, NPR One, and Apple Podcasts. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett. Our intern is Maria Alexa Cavanaugh, and our engineer is Valentina Rivera. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.